The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
A quick note before we begin. While the Lawfare podcast usually runs our Arbiters of Truth miniseries on disinformation on Thursdays, they are taking this week off. But don't worry. They'll be back on this feed, per usual, next Thursday.
The executive's view is that once Congress has given the president troops, it is for the president to say where to place the troops to best advance the national security of the United States. You know, President Bush I at one point said that Congress could not restrict his ability to relocate personnel away from a military base in Spain, because that was inconsistent with his judgment about the best way to advance U.S. national security and diplomacy. That continues through to the Trump administration's Justice Department as well, where you see language saying that Congress cannot require the Secretary of the Navy to assign a particular ship a home port in the United States. This is this claim that the executive really gets to decide when to fight, when to withdraw. And I think it links back to the president's repel attacks power.
I'm Scott R. Anderson, and this is the Lawfare podcast for September 17th, 2020. In recent years, Congress has taken unprecedented steps to push back against the Trump administration's efforts to pull U.S. troops from certain long-standing deployments overseas. The most recent such provision is contained in the House version of the National Defense Authorization Act for 2021 that is currently being debated, and would prohibit the president from reducing U.S. troop levels in Germany and Europe unless certain conditions are met. But does Congress have the authority to direct these deployments? Or does doing so interfere with the president's constitutional authority as commander-in-chief? To discuss these issues, I sat down with two legal experts who have written extensively on the subject. Ashley Deeks of the University of Virginia School of Law, and Zachary Price of the UC Hastings College of Law. We discussed the legal limits on Congress's authority over the military, what the president's commander-in-chief authority actually entails, and what it all means for the future of U.S. troop deployments overseas. It's the Lawfare podcast for September 17th, Congress's control over the military. So, among the many provisions of this year's National Defense Authorization Act, and specifically the House version, which adopts a lot more restrictions or provisions kind of questioning the Trump administration's policy, is a provision that is aimed at President Trump's intent to draw down troops from Germany and from Europe more broadly, which essentially tries to impose a number of restrictions on his authority to do that. Set some preconditions saying, Mr. President, you need to have certain certifications and findings. Actually, some of your subordinates need to make certain certifications and findings. And only after you do that and a substantial time passes, are you able to withdraw these troops below a certain level, a substantial level. It's a type of provision we've seen more often in recent years. There was a very similar provision regarding troop levels in South Korea that was adopted 2 years ago as part of the NDAA. We heard discussion of these sorts of provisions in the context of Syria drawdown, in passing in the context of Afghanistan drawdown. Maybe we'll hear them in regards to this new Iraq drawdown. Trump administration announced last week that it would be pursuing in advance of the election. And it raises pretty novel questions about who has the authority to direct the deployment of troops overseas, not just in times of war, but also in times of peace, or in terms of more permanent deployments, or at least long-term deployments like those of U.S. troops in Korea and Germany that have been there for decades. Ashley, let me start with you. Give us a sense of the history behind these sorts of provisions and these types of authorities. I think most people today assume this is the sort of thing that fits under the president's authority as a commander-in-chief, because certainly we see the president directing these sorts of deployments in many cases, and we associate his commander-in-chief authority with a lot of control over the military and national security policy generally. But has that always been the case? And how have the Congress and the presidency in the past worked out the authorities around these sorts of deployment questions?
Well, it's a good question with a long answer that I will try to keep relatively short. But it turns out that if you look to the text of the Constitution and you look at the views of the framers as those emerged at that time, and you look at the court cases that have occurred since then, and just in general, the kind of 200 plus years of history that we've had, where the president and sometimes with Congress have engaged in, you know, efforts to protect ourselves at home and abroad militarily, you can really find ample evidence on both sides of what we sometimes call the Article I, Article II debate about who really has the power to direct forces and regulate forces abroad. And so there is, in fact, ample evidence, particularly from before the Korean War, about Congress's ability to direct the locations and actions of troops broadly and otherwise to shape the boundaries of the U.S. forces fighting. I think it's generally agreed, however, that the president has at least some core powers, they're sometimes called preclusive powers, into which Congress can't intrude. But many of the executive's powers these days, which are not spelled out clearly in the Constitution beyond the Commander-in-Chief Clause, are inherent but not preclusive. That is, that Congress at least believes that it can still intrude in some of these powers. So this, frankly, becomes the big key debate, is how big is the core of the president's preclusive powers? I'll just say there are a range of historical examples that reflect efforts by Congress either to force the president to dispatch troops overseas or keep them overseas, or efforts that require the executive to do things with troops that he didn't want to do. And that's kind of what we're talking about specifically with the withdrawal provisions. So, for example, back in the Civil War, Congress was worried that President Lincoln was not prosecuting the Civil War as aggressively as they wanted him to, and they passed a statute in the Confiscation Acts of 1862 that required him to seize Southerners' property. So the statute said it shall be the duty of the president to seize all property of certain rebels. So you can see them giving a specific mandate to the president during an ongoing conflict to do certain military actions that he didn't want to do. We know, for example, from kind of the gloss of history that Congress can require the president to bring troops home within a certain time frame. So we see that in Vietnam and Lebanon and Somalia. And there's some other examples as well. At a certain point in time, Congress authorized a bunch of funds for Marines, but required those Marines to be employed in certain numbers on ships, even though the president was not happy about that. President Taft's attorney general conceded Congress's power to do that. So there are a few other examples as well. Maybe we can turn back to them. But there are some examples of the kinds of things that Congress is trying to do here. The only really specific example, though, is the one you noted, the 2020 NDAA. That's a very specific example that precedes the German no troop withdrawal from Germany effort that we are looking at now.
So, Zach, in a recent Law Review article, as well as a prior Law Review article, and in a recent piece for Lawfare, you kind of lay out an affirmative case asserting why, in your view at least, the president has the authority to direct action like this, among other sorts of control that he or she may exercise over the military structure. Can you give us a sense of that argument? What is the affirmative case that Congress has the constitutional authority to direct troop deployments like this, whether it is maintaining troops where there already were some, or perhaps sending troops to a new area on a new mission that presidency hasn't previously undertaken?
Sure. So if you think about a provision like the one you described for Germany or the one on the books for Korea. I think there are really two aspects to what Congress is doing. The first is just mandating the troop deployment in the first place. So the question being, can Congress require the troops be put in some location and not others? So that's one. And then secondly, at least the Korea provision conditions a withdrawal on certain certifications, not by the president, but by the Secretary of Defense. So it puts kind of authority over key decision points in the process in an official other than the president. And so I think both those things are constitutional. On the first one, I think the key congressional power is its authority over appropriations, and in particular over military resources. So Congress has the power of the purse. No treasury funds can be spent without an appropriation by law. And then more generally, Congress has the power to raise armies, maintain navies, and so forth. So there's a general puzzle that I addressed in the first article you mentioned, a piece from a couple years ago. There's a general puzzle about how Congress's power of appropriation fits together with constitutional executive authorities. So to what degree can Congress use its power of the purse to dictate how presidents exercise executive powers? And my view, which I think is supported by the constitutional text and structure, as well as the kind of broad contours of historical practice, is that the answer really depends on whether the president needs resources from Congress to exercise the power in the first place. So within that framework, you know, the president is commander-in-chief, which presumably means he has some power to issue lawful commands to the military. And that's not something he needs resources from Congress to do. It's something he can do personally, just issue whatever lawful commands he thinks are appropriate. But on the other hand, right, whether there's any military at all is entirely dependent on congressional appropriation. So I think it follows that Congress can impose pretty much whatever conditions or restrictions it wants on the military apparatus through which the president's commands or chosen policies would be executed. And so I think that power of resources gives Congress the power to make the military available for certain purposes and not others, or require forces to be located in some places and not others. And there's a lot of practice supporting that in terms of kind of negative restraints, Congress saying you can't put troops one place or another. And presidents have sometimes objected or resisted to those sorts of restrictions, but I think by and large, they've actually complied with them. For example, at the end of the Cold War, Congress limited the number of troops that could be located in Europe and Japan. President George H.W. Bush objected on constitutional grounds, but if you look at the actual levels of troops over time, he essentially complied with the conditions. So that's just one example, but I think it seems pretty clearly established that Congress can exercise that power negatively. I mean, Ashley mentioned the Vietnam example is really important also. So the only question would be, is there anything different about mandating deployment rather than restricting it? And I think there's not really any good conceptual reason to distinguish between the two. They're both Congress exercising this power to provide a military for certain purposes or not others, impose certain conditions on what military resources are available to the president as commander-in-chief. And there are, if not precise precedents, as Ashley also mentioned, there are things that are clearly in the sort of ballpark. In particular, you know, Congress has regulated where troops are located domestically, and presidents objected at certain times, but have really accepted that power. Presidents also used to impound military funds, refused to spend money for weapons or programs they didn't think were appropriate, but Congress has greatly restricted that authority in the Impoundment Control Act, and presidents have largely accepted it. So I think Congress has this power over military resources that entails an authority to require them to be placed in some locations and not others. So that's the first issue. And then the second one is the question, well, what about vesting the decision-making authority in the Secretary of Defense rather than the president? And that's the point I addressed in a forthcoming article and wrote about on Lawfare. And I think, again, there's a lot of historical practice and strong textual and structural arguments to support doing that. So the president, again, is commander in chief, which means he should be able to issue lawful commands to the military and must have some way of giving effect to those commands, so of sort of disciplining people who don't follow them. But in general, the sort of default disciplinary mechanism is just the power to fire officers. And in some cases, Congress has provided other disciplinary mechanisms, such as court-martial discipline for disobedience or insubordination. So I think within that kind of narrow limitation, Congress has a lot of room to structure the military apparatus through which the president's commands are executed. So even apart from those powers of appropriation and so forth that I mentioned earlier, right, Congress has the power to make rules and regulations for the government and the military. It has the necessary and proper clause, gives it power over to pass laws necessary and proper to carrying out functions of offices throughout the government. It creates offices, defines their authorities and responsibilities. And it routinely uses that in both the civil and military context to sort of design the governmental structures through which any presidential directives are carried out. And I think all that adds up to a power to in this case, right, they can give the Secretary of Defense the authority, the responsibility to make certain certifications. The president might be able to direct the secretary about what to do and fire him or her if the secretary doesn't comply. But ultimately, the responsibility would be in that office rather than in the president. And that can be significant because it elevates the political cost to the president getting his way if it's contrary to what the secretary thinks is appropriate or warranted. And again, this is a technique that Congress uses in designing the executive branch, not only in the military and national security context, but in civil administration as well. And it's a way that Congress can encourage certain policy outcomes or just more generally protect a certain decision-making process, protect certain norms of governance. And so I think it's quite valuable, and I do think it's well supported historically.
So, Ashley, you are, of course, a former executive branch lawyer from your days before entering into academia. How would you expect the executive branch to respond to these sorts of arguments that Zach's laying out, both from a legal perspective in terms of the arguments they're going to make? Of course, they're going to issue a signing statement on whatever law comes out, most likely, as they almost always do with NDAAs, but also in terms of their actual policy follow-up or other actions they may pursue afterwards. Is there a legal argument that they have that they are almost certain to deploy here? And then how much of that is actually going to guide their degree of compliance?
So we see lots of executive statements in response to a range of statutes out of Congress, especially over the past 20 years. And these statements grow, I'd say, more aggressive over time in terms of the breadth of what the president's preclusive powers are. And you find lots and lots of objections to Congress's efforts to do anything regarding troops, including the kinds of conditioning of appropriations that Zach just mentioned. And you can see this not only in signing statements when the president signs a bill, but also in DOJ views letters on drafts of legislation, and also in OLC opinions, of course. And you will sometimes see these executive documents citing to themselves, like you see court decisions citing to precedent. And substantively, I think the executive's view is that once Congress has given the president troops, it is for the president to say where to place the troops and equipment to best advance the national security of the United States. So, you know, President Bush the First at one point said that Congress could not restrict his ability to relocate personnel away from a military base in Spain, because that was inconsistent with his judgment about the best way to advance U.S. national security and diplomacy. That continues through to the Trump administration's Justice Department as well, where you see language saying that Congress cannot require the Secretary of the Navy to assign a particular ship a home port in the United States. This is this claim that the executive really gets to decide when to fight where to fight, when to withdraw. And I think it links back to the president's repel attacks power, right, which is a core power recognized even back at the time of the framing, that the executive is best positioned to judge where to station the U.S. armed forces to deter attacks and to be prepared to meet attacks by foreign states or non-state actors. Famously, former legal advisor Meeker during the Vietnam War wrote a letter explaining the U.S. government's position and noted that it was for the president to decide whether attacks on Vietnam were effectively attacks that the U.S. had to respond to for its national security reasons in a kind of repel attacks type argument. So these executive assertions are very broad, and yet they leave some ambiguity about what particular aspects of a legislative provision are or aren't within bounds. And so that connects, I think, to your second question, which is, what does the executive do after it's objected to these various statutory provisions? And it turns out that the executive often does comply with the provisions of the statutes. There are lots of examples where the executive has acted consistent with statutory direction, even as it objected to it as a constitutional matter. In fact, there are very few examples of the president acting in what's sometimes called Justice Jackson's Category 3 from the Steele seizures case. That is, where the president is acting in specific defiance of a statute. I think you can count those examples on one hand. The president prefers to be in what's Jackson's Category 1, which is seen to be acting consistent with a statute. And so maybe we can talk a little bit later about why that's the case, why the executive does tend to follow the words, even as they object to them as a legal matter.
So Zach, I want to go back to part of your argument about where this authority comes from and drill down into it a little bit. Your most recent article, as you mentioned, really focuses on this ability of Congress to structure the decision-making assignments and duties of inferior officials within the executive branch and within the military and Defense Department, guiding these sorts of war-making decisions. Now, in theory, that's a fairly broad authority, I think, as you describe it, in terms of making individual officials responsible for certain types of decisions. But we often see it manifesting in kind of a novel or unique way, which is through these certifications, as you noted, where essentially Congress says, before the executive branch can undertake X action, official Y, some inferior official, whether it's Secretary of Defense or Assistant Secretary of Defense or someone else in the decision-making structure, has to certify that certain conditions are met publicly to Congress, in writing, verbally, maybe under no description exactly how. But it's a sort of gateway event. Why is it that that's often the way we see Congress using this authority? And could it use it more broadly to, for instance, make lower-level officials more broadly responsible for actually formulating and generating the actual policy pursued by the executive branch? And even if it could legally, are there practical reasons why Congress very rarely, as far as I can tell, at least in recent years, chooses to do so?
Sure. So I think, to start with the last point, I mean, I think there are very good practical reasons why Congress tends to give the president and the executive branch a degree of flexibility, so it tends not to really tightly structure chains of command, or often will kind of create a default structure, but allow some flexibility to change things. And I don't know why this method of certification has been the way it's chosen to do things, except maybe it seems like a fairly unobtrusive way of regulating the process. I mean, really what it's doing is it's giving the secretary a kind of authority to decide whether the withdrawal can happen, but it does so just by making the secretary certify that certain conditions are met and kind of preserves the president's ultimate authority over the decision. But in any event, I think that Congress does have a very broad weight and power to structure chains of command, vest duties in particular offices. And, you know, if you look historically, it's organized and reorganized the military apparatus many times. I mean, for much of the country's history, the Navy and War Departments were separate cabinet departments, covering the Army and the Navy. And when Congress created more unified command structures through the creation of the Department of Defense, and then eventually with the command structure and the Goldwater Nichols Act, there have been, you know, extensive congressional debates over whether these choices were wise. And that whole debate wouldn't make much sense if, so presidents will sometimes say that they're not bound by these sort of statutes, that they have authority to decide who within the military can carry out any particular duty. But I think that's very much in the category Ashley was mentioning of things presidents assert. But if you look at the actual practice, right, it's not really the way the government has worked. So probably the time when it used this power most aggressively, when Congress used it most aggressively, was during Reconstruction. It vested specific authority. So during the so-called military Reconstruction, it divided the defeated Confederacy into different districts, vested specific powers in the district commanders. It also required all army orders to go through the chief general of the army, who was Ulysses Grant. And this was clear in a context where Congress was in conflict with President Johnson over Reconstruction policy. And Johnson could fire the district commanders, right? But putting these authorities in them and requiring the directives to them to go through Grant, it put some friction, right, between the president's desires and what the military did. And so, for example, in one episode, General Sheridan exercised those powers to take actions President Johnson didn't like and got fired, but it really elevated the political salience of the issue and had important on-ground consequences. So that's probably the most aggressive example. But you see kind of milder versions of this across the 200 years of Congress designing different chains of command, putting different authorities in different offices. And if you look today, you know, there are lots of statutes that define the duties of particular provisions. And if more generally, right, there's an organic statute for the Department of Defense that allows the secretary to transfer or consolidate certain authorities for efficiency reasons. But then it also says he can't, quote, substantially transfer, reassign, consolidate, or abolish authorities vested in particular positions unless the president authorizes it in an emergency situation. So again, there's a lot of flexibility built in there, and it probably, you know, makes practical sense. But that statute wouldn't make any sense if Congress didn't have the power to kind of assign duties and calibrate the degree to which presidents can choose to depart from the prescribed structure. So there's a kind of implicit constitutional theory that it's up to Congress to design the military apparatus through which any presidential commands are carried out. And it could use that more aggressively than it normally does if it chose to. And I think that these provisions, like the Germany and South Korea ones, are just an exercise of that power.
Now, I want to follow up about one aspect of this, and that is the distinction between establishing these sorts of delegations for civilian versus military officials. Because, of course, the military operates under a statutory, in fact, chain of command, although I know there are arguments that part of it may be constitutional, and so it's not clear extent to which, you know, this chain of command would be enforceable absent the statutory requirements. But nonetheless, they are there. Military officials, of course, you know, have to follow orders from their commanders, from their chain of command, unless they're unlawful. The bar for that is extremely high. And so, you know, you have this sort of degree of baked-in presidential control, because as the president is kind of at the head of the chain of command, that goes down military structures, but not civilian structures. Does that impact the ability to delegate these sorts of authorities to lower ranking officials, which it's worth noting, at least in my time looking at these provisions, they almost always go to civilian officials, not military officials. I can't think of a contrary example. I suspect they're out there historically, but recently I haven't seen any examples of that. Or is it possible, is that UCMJ requirement or similar requirements something that Congress can confidently or should be confident in superseding so that they don't need to restrict themselves between civilian and military officials in that way?
So I think I don't see a kind of constitutional reason why it couldn't choose between the civilian leadership and actual military officers. It tends to maintain a separation, which I think is, you know, there are a lot of good reasons for that. But in both cases, right, it's really just Congress exercising a power to create offices, define their responsibilities, vest them with particular duties and authorities. So I don't see a good conceptual reason to, you know, in some sense that giving it to the secretary is the military office insofar as it's exercising powers within a chain of command and controlling military functions. So I think it has a lot of discretion there. In terms of civil versus military, so, you know, this takes us into kind of unitary executive branch issues. I mean, it, you know, is the military different from civil administration domestically? As listeners may know, right, there's a big debate that tends to focus more on civil administration than on the military about whether Congress can create independent agencies or whether the president, either through the Take Care Clause or by virtue of being vested with executive power, you know, has to have ultimate authority over how civil administrative powers are exercised. And the Supreme Court has allowed at least some kind of genuine independence where you have the president can't remove certain officers at will, and they're vested with particular authorities that belong to the officer rather than the president. So in a way, I'm arguing for a parallel structure in the military, except that I think the Commander-in-Chief Clause means you couldn't create a genuinely independent military, right? So the president has to have some way of enforcing military commands. But the default mechanism for doing so is just the power to remove an officer from their position. So in that sense, I think at the end of the day, there's not that much difference from, say, giving the Secretary of Defense a sort of certification authority, where the president can direct the secretary how to use it. But if the secretary really wants to dig his or her heels in, could force the president to fire the secretary to get his way. I mean, that's a similar sort of structure that exists for certain authorities for, say, the attorney general on the civilian side. I think in both cases, just that power to kind of put duties in offices, even if they're subject to at-will removal, is a way that Congress can encourage certain outcomes or at least create a kind of political constraint on certain actions that Congress views as undesirable. So if the president has to fire the officer to get his way, that, you know, an extreme situation could really elevate the stakes of doing so. So the famous example is the Saturday Night Massacre in the Nixon administration, where the president had to fire first the attorney general and then the deputy and down the chain to get rid of a special prosecutor. And so I think you could have the same sort of structure as a practical matter with the military, even though the president there is commander in chief.
Ashley, let me turn to you with another aspect of these authorities and provisions that we've seen, and that is the tie to the power of the purse, which I think a lot of folks, both on Capitol Hill, off of Capitol Hill, see as the trump card for Congress, the ability to cut off funding for various that type of activity. Certainly since that authority was used to help force the end of the Vietnam War, at least by many accounts, then it's played this kind of overpowered role, or played very large in the imagination of people, for Congress's ability to regulate and constrain military activities. Is there a reason why that in these sorts of situations, the appropriations power should play such a larger role than simple statutory authority to prohibit things or direct certain things? And if not, why is it that it's come to assume this role?
Mm-hmm. I think it has come to be seen as the trump card. And so just one background point to make, which is, of course, in the war powers area, or in the area of kind of military force and control of the troops, the executive has the first mover advantage, right? It has the best ability to collect intelligence. It has, by and large, the control over the Department of Defense and all of its internal mechanisms. It controls diplomacy. So it's got all of these levers in the field. It really knows what's going on out there in the world in a way that it can be hard for Congress to know, right? Congress sits back in DC and in some ways is beholden to the executive for a lot of information it has about conflicts and politically tense situations and so on. So I think that feeds into why Congress has started to use appropriations for kind of the most effective regulation of this area. It's because the executive needs money to do these things. It sounds very obvious, but I think Congress has had, you know, a lot of experiences in the past where the executive has tried to interpret around statutes, including those that don't involve appropriations, and it's felt foiled. I mean, if you think about the wind down of the Vietnam War, that's maybe a good example of Congress trying and trying and trying and having a hard time, but ultimately being successful in helping wind down the war through appropriations tools. I'll note that the executive, I think, would probably reject Zach's view of the ability to attach conditions on appropriations. I think Zach's view is the lesser, that is, conditions on appropriations is subsumed within the greater, which is Congress's power to appropriate. I think OLC would say, actually, Congress can't attach conditions to appropriations that would require the operation of government in an unconstitutional way. So if you think that the Constitution gives the commander-in-chief preclusive authority to engage in broad tactical and strategic control, OLC would say Congress can't add conditions to the appropriations that infringe on that preclusive control. But notice that just kicks us back to the earlier debate we've already fleshed out. So I guess two more points to make about Congress and the use of appropriations. So the first is that the executive doesn't want, I think, to bite the hand that feeds it. So to the extent that we see the executive complying with a range of statutes that it has objected to at some level, I suspect its approach is, you know, as long as those statutes are more or less consistent with what we want to do, then we're going to comply with them and we're not going to annoy our overseers. We're not going to annoy our appropriators because we need them for lots of other things too, not just the particular, you know, disputed issue, but for the whole department and for the whole military apparatus, the whole intelligence apparatus. And the second thing operating in the background, I think, is this statute that's called the Anti-Deficiency Act. This is a statute that prevents people in the executive branch from incurring obligations or spending money in excess of amounts made available by appropriations. So I don't think there have been a lot of criminal prosecutions under the Anti-Deficiency Act, although it does contain a criminal provision, but it does, the statute envisions that the Government Accountability Office, GAO, which is a legislative body, can investigate what it thinks might be Anti-Deficiency Act violations, and inspectors general can also investigate those violations. So I think individual members of the executive branch will be nervous about acting in the face of the kinds of congressional statutes that we're talking about here, such as the withdrawal or no withdrawal provisions, because they're worried they're going to run afoul of the Anti-Deficiency Act.
Now, all of these provisions boil down to one kind of key question that again, looms very large in any sort of discussion around the separation of powers in this space. And that's the enforceability question, the ability of any sort of legal restriction, whether it's on appropriations or whether it's on the delegation of authority by Congress, to actually be enforced in a way that the executive branch, where it doesn't wish to, will nonetheless feel obligated to comply or compelled to comply. The courts usually play this role, but in this space, the justiciability of these sorts of questions has often come into debate, and the subject of debate, whether it's outright considered non-justiciable as a political question where you have these sorts of tension between the branches, whether there are some preconditions. In addition, questions of standing, the ability of individual legislators to be able to pursue these sorts of lawsuits has been questioned. Although to my knowledge, I don't think we've seen an actual case where Congress as a whole has sought to pursue an authorized litigation on its behalf as an institution and these sorts of steps. Zach, that's a question I really think for you in these arguments you're advancing. What are the enforcement mechanisms you see coming into play here? And are there ways that Congress can improve the prospects of securing judicial review and judicial enforcement? And if not, what are the other enforcement mechanisms? Is it just, you know, the fact that these are going to be iterative interactions where the executive has to keep Congress kind of on its side? Or are there other enforcement mechanisms in play that may be viewed as a bigger sanction, for example, by a Brinksman president, somebody who's willing to put the relationship with Congress in the long term on the line to advance short-term goals?
Sure. Well, it's a really important question, sort of how separation of powers principles get enforced, particularly when they're case on issues that aren't likely to be litigated or where courts may say it's not justiciable. And I mean, as Ashley was discussing, it is sort of interesting that Congress seems to get its way pretty well in the appropriations context and frames a lot of restrictions in that way. So even the National Defense Authorization Act we've been talking about, the provisions will often say it would be framed in terms of no funds authorized by the act being available to do certain things. So why does the executive branch comply so much? I think Ashley hit on the key reasons. I mean, to the extent the Anti-Deficiency Act is a key piece of it, it's worth noting that executive officials used to pretty regularly create what were called coercive deficiencies. They would promise people money beyond what was available in their agency's appropriations. And Congress felt like it had to then honor those obligations. And the Anti-Deficiency Act was aimed at eliminating that practice. So it was passed in the late 19th century and then kind of strengthened over time. And it seems to have been quite effective, even though, as Ashley mentioned, it's not, at least the criminal provision for willful violations hasn't really been enforced at all, or at least only very rarely. So maybe that mechanism of kind of creating a really serious personal liability in individual officials is a way that Congress can ensure compliance in the executive branch, even if the president wants to try and override it. The people have to actually carry out those directives are going to be nervous if they have a personal responsibility. So perhaps that could be, used in other areas on the kind of impoundment control side, for example. Maybe you could use the same sort of mechanisms. As for kind of involving the courts, I think there are really two problems that come up in this area. One is the kind of standing question. The Supreme Court has been hostile to legislative standing, letting either one house or the other or individual members of Congress bring suit to protect their authority over the power of the purse. The courts generally think Congress has its own tools for enforcing those authorities, so courts shouldn't get involved in that direct political conflict. So there's that standing problem, and then there's the political question doctrine, where courts often say if it's a matter of kind of war and peace or whether military force is authorized, that's a political question that the political branches need to work out. So if Congress wanted to, I think it could make it much harder for courts to take that position if it passed legislation creating a specific cause of action and authorizing certain types of suits. So if it tried to kind of max out Article 3 standing in some way and create a certain cause of action and maybe even defined the standards courts should apply so that they can't say there aren't any judicially manageable standards. So what that would look like in different contexts might vary. But, for example, there was a case a while back about President Clinton's missile strike on a chemical factory, I think it was in Sudan, and the owners of the factory that was damaged tried to sue and say the government destroyed their property without adequate justification. And the DC Circuit said, it's a political question, we're not going to answer this. So if Congress had passed a statute that authorized property owners of that sort to sue and collect damages to recover in that sort of circumstance, I think it would be a lot harder for courts to reach that conclusion. So I think that, at least in certain contexts, that sort of mechanism could be a way of involving courts. But in general, I think these questions probably, for the most part, will and probably should remain more in this kind of uneasy political give and take, where Congress can use its powers of oversight and overfunding in other areas to try and beat up the executive branch politically for doing things it doesn't like or violating norms or provisions that thinks are important.
So we're running towards the end of our time, but I want to close with one kind of question for both of you. And Ashley, I'll come to you with this first. And that is, based off the survey of these different authorities, we've talked about the practice we've seen Congress pursue historically and more recently, to some degree, the extent of both branches being, at least historically, never really walking up to the edge of the constitutional conflict, but both kind of stepping back and not pushing to that limit, but getting closer, it seems, at least from a kind of subjective perspective in recent years. What should we really be looking for in this area moving forward, both kind of observationally and prescriptively? What should we expect Congress to be doing? Maybe what should Congress be looking at doing moving forward if there continues to be tension around these questions of military deployments?
Sure. Well, I think it's safe to say there will continue to be such tensions around these deployments. And, you know, I think most people think at this point that the relationship between Congress and the executive is pretty lopsided in favor of the executive branch. So I do think there are a number of steps that Congress could take to try to reframe the narrative a little bit, to try to counter what we sometimes refer to as the historical gloss that has allowed the executive to accrue really a huge range of power in this area. So the first thing I think Congress could do is it could start to respond in writing to these presidential signing statements and these views letters from the Justice Department, to set forth their own views of what the Constitution and the history of our country reflects in terms of Congress's power to legislate in this area. And it might well be that these are individual members writing letters, or even better, committees getting together and writing basically legal analyses to sort of contest the ground that offices like the Office of Legal Counsel have really staked out in this area. The second thing, it's sort of related on this idea of altering the gloss that has taken us in the direction of real executive power here, kind of unfettered power, is for Congress to do what it seems to start to have been doing with the withdrawals, which is repeatedly enact the same kind of statute. So we've seen it in the 2019-2020 NDAA. Maybe we'll see it in the 2021 NDAA as well, where you're basically undoing what the executive has been relying on as a systematic and unbroken executive practice of having exclusive control in this area. And this is that's an example, these statutes are an example of Congress pushing back and saying, that's not actually how we construe our constitutional powers. The third thing it could do, and others have suggested this as well, is really kind of vet the heads of the new head of the Office of Legal Counsel when there's a new leadership by diving in and trying to discuss specific war powers hypotheticals and asking opinions about past Office of Legal Counsel opinions, which are really the bread and butter of what the next opinions build on. So really making sure Congress has a clear sense of what the OLC leadership thinks about these very specific questions in the war powers area. And then the final thing comes back to something I think Zach and I both mentioned, which is that we do see a lot of executive compliance with these statutes, even where the president's objected. And I think it would behoove Congress to start to compile examples of this kind of executive compliance to potentially kind of challenge some of the assertions that we see, these bold and broad constitutional assertions of executive unilateral authority.
Zach, let me turn it to you for the last word.
Sure. So I think all of Ashley's suggestions are really excellent and things people in Congress should take seriously. I mean, I think on the broader point, particularly since World War II, right, particularly in the national security area, we've seen the executive branch acquire a lot of power of initiative in setting policy. And, you know, there are good and bad reasons for that, right? But in a dangerous world, you know, nuclear weapons, and where the U.S. has global interests, right? We often need to respond rapidly to situations. And that's led to the executive branch acquiring a lot of power to act on its own initiative. But I think what's important is that the power to act kind of in the absence of legislation or restrictions from Congress shouldn't imply a power to act in the face of or in defiance of restrictions that Congress chooses to impose. So Congress is often in a kind of reactive posture And this might be another reason why you see so much pushback coming in the form of annual appropriations laws or the annual defense authorization bills, because that's where Congress can react to choices the executive branch has made that it doesn't support. And I think, you know, the extent that basic idea of separation of powers is that we want checks and balances, we want productive tension between different elements of the government. I think it's really important to preserve those reactive authorities on Congress's part and not let kind of overbroad assertions by the executive branch shape the understanding of whether they're valid. As Ashley mentioned, the fact of the matter is the executive branch often complies with these things despite objecting, and to the extent practice is an important feature in constitutional interpretation, as I believe it is, what the practice should be what the government ends up doing, not what one branch or the other necessarily said. And so if I think we keep that mindset, we should be able to better tell when the executive branch is really departing from an operative understanding that everyone was taking for granted as a practical matter. And I think it's important to find ways to protect those limits, those checks and balances, particularly as our politics get increasingly conflicted and people tend to view all these questions through a partisan lens. We need to find ways to maintain the basic checks and balances in Congress's authorities.
Well, we will have to leave the conversation there for now. Ashley and Zach, thank you very much for joining us here today on the Lawfare Podcast.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks very much.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to rate and review this podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you might be listening. This podcast was engineered by Megan Adolsky of Goad Rodeo and edited by Jen Patcha Howell. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.